Representative Mahoney is blocking you, so we have a quorum now, and Representative Gravel, would you move to approve the minutes from February 21st, 22nd, 23rd, and March 2nd?
I'd be happy to do so, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gravel, move the minutes from February 21st through 23rd and the 22nd of March. All in favor? Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. No, we got the... Representative Lang. I will move House File 2819. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Representative Maury Lanning. And 2819 is a bill that I'm carrying. What this bill does is to establish a pilot study with a $250,000 grant that has to be matched from funds from other sources. Here last year, DEED provided the West Central Initiative Fund with a $100,000 startup grant to sort of start testing out a program that's proven to be successful in the state of North Carolina. And what this program, what the pilot study is all about, is an attempt to help people move from MFIP into their permanent position. Right now, the MFIP support ends as soon as they get their job. And what this program does is provide some assistance ongoing so as to reduce the recidivism. We have a large number of people who end up back on MFIP because they are not getting the kind of support they need to make the transition into their permanent employment. And so the effect of this, we believe, as demonstrated elsewhere, like in the state of North Carolina, is to eventually save the state a considerable amount of money. We estimate that this investment on the part of the state of Minnesota, $250,000 grant matched by another $250,000, has the potential of saving the state nearly $2 million. And if this pilot study proves effective, I think we're going to want to be looking at this for a longer-term implementation. I have with me today Deborah Carpenter, who is from the West Central Initiative Fund, and Steve Nagel, who is on the board for Northern Connections, this pilot study group. And I just want to say that the initiative funds, the West Central Fund, is one of six that the McKnight Foundation set up 20 years ago. And from my experience, I served on the board of the initiative fund for the first 6 years, saw it get started, and have watched it ever since. They have done a tremendous job with so many different programs in support of activities and charitable activities in our region. And I have full confidence that these folks will do a tremendous job in administering and overseeing this pilot study. So at this time, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have Deborah Carpenter from the Initiative Fund say some more about the program.
Ms. Carpenter, welcome to our committee, and give your name for the record. Welcome again.
My name is Deborah Carpenter. I'm a project executive for Northern Connections at West Central Initiative in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. We serve a 9-county region in West Central Minnesota. As Representative Lanning told you, the Northern Connections project has been proven in North Carolina. It's based on a model that's been in place for 5 years there and has been able to reduce the rate of people going back on the federal TANF program considerably. So they've reduced the rates in various counties that were 30 to 50% down to less than 10%. In our region of the state, 36% of people will go back on Minnesota Family Investment Program within 12 months of going off of the program. So we know that people have difficulty remaining independent, and this program is really designed to support them and reduce the chance that they will not be able to retain their independence. Representative Lanning said, we did receive a startup grant from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We have a grant for operations from West Central Initiative for $100,000, which for West Central Initiative is a very significant contribution. One of the communities in our area has given us a lease for $1 per month because they're very anxious to see this program up and running in the community. That is equivalent to about $24,000. So, you know, there's a huge community commitment to this program. We know that in our area there's about 2,000 families a year that go off of Minnesota Family Investment Program, and about 700 will come back on the program within that first year. The case rate in our area, the average case rate, is $583 a month. So there's a significant cost to the state in people coming back on the program. There's a cost to the individuals who have, you know, a chance to be independent and fail at that. There's a cost to the employer who's gone through, hired somebody, trained them, and now has to remake that investment. And there's a cost to the community because those individuals could have greater earning power and be contributing to their community in other ways and are not able to do that. The program is unique in that it uses technology, and so it's very efficient. So where a typical face-to-face kind of program like this might be able to see about 5 customers a day, because this is done telephonically, we're able to connect with about 25 to 30 people a day. And we're able to do that over a period of time more frequent than you would be able to do in a face-to-face kind of program. We would have more extensive hours than you would typically see. We're planning on 63 hours a week, so it would be 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. because we know people work different schedules and we need to accommodate their schedules and their needs. It's easy for customers to use because they don't have to arrange daycare, travel, all those other things that are difficult for families in rural areas and even in metropolitan areas. It builds skills because there's coaching and modeling that occurs with the counselors. The counselors typically are bachelor's or master's level social workers, and they hold customers accountable. They'll initiate the contact through a three-way calling system while the person's on the phone. So, you know, really getting people into the habit of working through the problem immediately. It does not duplicate current programs. It partners with existing programs to make referrals early on. It's a very proactive system to avoid letting people fail in the system, but it really does work very closely with places like workforce centers, other organizations that might be able to help people with their needs. And it really has been a very effective program in North Carolina. They began in 6 counties. They're now in 17 counties. So it's got some proven results. What kind of questions might I be able to answer for you?
Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the proven results in North Carolina? Is there some way to monitor the how much recidivism has decreased?
Yes, they have been monitoring that. Over the course of their program, they have been able to reduce recidivism to less than 10%. So they've been able to reduce it significantly.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know exactly what North Carolina's program is, but you said something about when a person gets a job, they lose their NFIP, and that depends. We have a kind of a sliding fee, a sliding scale kind of thing. So we try to incent people to move up in their job, but oftentimes people get a job and still are on NFIP, and the amount they get is based on their income. I don't know if North Carolina has, but we have a whole set of assistance programs. I mean, the only thing you're talking about is the NFIP cash, and as I said, even that is kind of slides as people have jobs. But in addition to that, if they're receiving child care support, that would continue. If they're receiving medical benefits, likely those would continue. If they're receiving food benefits, those would continue. Many states have those kind of packaged in sort of their welfare. So I'm not so sure that we sort of characterize these people as they're suddenly on a cliff. They're not in Minnesota. And I've only given you a sampling. I could probably give you another 10 benefits like renter's credits and all kinds of other things that do continue. So I'm struggling a little bit here with sort of the picture of these people just kind of a cliff. We specifically designed, I was part of the design of our MFIT program, and we specifically designed it so that it wasn't a cliff. Could you comment on that, please?
Yes. You are speaking about some of the services that people receive in terms of financial services. What they don't typically receive, though, are the supportive services, the services that might help them be able to address the issues that might become barriers to them continuing employment. And those services aren't there once they're off of, once they've found employment. So there's a lot of services that go into helping them find employment, but not services in terms of helping them problem solve for issues that come up on the job and then may cause them to either lose their job involuntarily or have to quit their job because they don't know how to problem solve. And those are the kind of services that have, in studies like the Families Forward Project or other projects, have been the services that really make a difference in people being successful. So those are the types of services, and making sure that they get connected early on rather than have the barrier get too far down the road and cause them to go back on the program. Obviously, with a recidivism rate of 36%, you know, people are not as well equipped as we'd like them to be.
Thank you.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned that recidivism has been brought down to 10% in North Carolina, but I didn't catch what the original rate was.
It varied by county. It was 30% in some counties. It was 50% in other counties. You know, I think in our state, as mentioned, we're probably in a different state of evolution of our Minnesota Family Investment Program than North Carolina is. And I would expect that we might be able to reduce that in half. I don't think we'll get it down to 10%, quite frankly, because I think our program has evolved. I think some of the people who were the people that were easier to move into employment have moved into employment. We're dealing with people who have much more complex issues facing them. And, you know, I think that it's realistic to get to a 15% recidivism rate. I don't think we'll get down to 10% as they have.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any comments from Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that this is a good potential investment to the state, and has, as I mentioned, and as Ms. Carpenter has mentioned, the potential of saving us money down the road. And I certainly urge you to consider approving this pilot study to see if in fact, that does prove to be that successful.
Could I mention one other thing?
Certainly, Ms. Carpenter.
Our federal WIA dollars in this state, as in any state, have been continued to be decreased. And I think it's really important as a state that we look to alternative methods of service delivery. And I think this is one method that really has potential for providing results and yet a lot of efficiencies that currently we're not able to gain in the traditional face-to-face kind of system. And I think as a, you know, that's a challenge that we face here in Minnesota.
Seeing no other questions, I will renew my motion to have House File 2819 laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. All in favor of that, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Passes. Thank you very much. Next on our agenda we have Representative Clark. Somebody likes to open their mouth. Trails wouldn't be in our committee, would it? one that's coming up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity.
Welcome to your committee.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Do you want to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 2068. Is that right? 2068. That's the right number.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I believe there's an amendment.
If you'd like to move that to be in your bill.
If you would, if the committee would accept the amendment, it basically brings this bill up to date in terms of the current appropriations. We're just dealing with 1 year's appropriation here. So the previous bill dealt with the 2 years appropriations.
Okay. Very well.
Mr. Chairman, members, the bill that you have before you as amended would restore the funding that was cut to some of the, to three youth programs, after-school youth programs and programs that deal with job training in particular, those kind of opportunities for young people in our state. Last year, this committee was very good. We heard this bill. We passed it out, but Mr. Chairman, the governor selectively vetoed the Learn to Earn program, which is the program of young people I have right before me right now. And there were cuts in the other programs. I want to thank the chairman for finding money for two of the programs, the youth build program and also the Minnesota Youth Program, and finding ways that we could fund those through other means in this committee. However, and I have to look at the three programs, we have lots of youth who are left behind because of those cuts, because of the veto, and I'm hoping now that we have a little bit of money on hand and the opportunity, maybe we can go back and make our young people a priority again and try to fund these programs. They're such good programs for job training, crime prevention, just hope for our youth. So I have with me some folks from the Learn to Earn program. I'll let them introduce themselves. We've got a couple of students as well as over here.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record.
Linda Patrick.
Welcome again.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm the project coordinator for the Park Board's Earn to Learn Teen Teamworks program. This will be our 20th summer that we're going to be in operation. We worked very hard to get the structure for this program going, and it really does help the youth that are involved with the program. Unfortunately, it's gotten to be like a lottery for these kids to be involved, and it helps them on so many levels. Last year, because of the cuts, I only sent out 300 applications because I knew I was only going to have between 80 and 90 positions to be able to fill, and I received 800. And the calls kept coming, and asking for this job kept coming. This training program works on the basics for these kids. It makes them, in the future, contributing members of our community. We do everything we can to make sure that they have a safe, structured environment, so that they learn the basics, they know how to get a job, keep a job. We keep helping them in the future. After the summer's over, we don't just let them go. We're there for their support, to help them get their next job, or if they need more help, they're welcome to come back into the program the following year. I brought a couple of the youth. I know you'd rather speak to them than to me. I think we've proven by the last 20 years that it's a good program and it does work. And so I've got Christina Diaz and Molly Etchison with me. They are both members of the TeenWorks Earn to Learn program last summer, and I'll just turn it over to them, and if you have any questions to follow up with.
Well, can I give your name for the record, so in the Historical Society, 100 years from now, we can prove you were here.
My name is Molly Etchison. Without the Earn to Learn program, I would not have had a job. It helped me to stay out of trouble. I learned how to use a lot of different tools, and it helped me, and I helped make the park safe. Everyone says how kids are so important, but every time you turn around, more programs like this and at our schools are being cut.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Christina. I know a lot of kids who couldn't find a job. They were bored all summer and got in trouble. I was able to keep up with my skills for school and because I earned my own money, I was able to buy my own clothes for school. Everyone in the program was very nice. I felt very safe there. There should be more jobs like this for other kids.
Very well. Representative Clark.
Any questions from the committee? Again, these are in a public parks, and I think...
Is this a Minneapolis program only?
Yes, it helps the city of Minneapolis, the youth in the city of Minneapolis.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, what was left in the program is what the city put in itself, so you can see.
How much was that?
Our budget last summer was, $366,000.
Okay.
So we had a few businesses that kicked in last summer.
Very well.
So.
Any questions from the members? Seeing none.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask the next program to come up. Thank you very much for your testimony. I guess if we were going to look at the waiting list there, we'd be talking around something like 720 kids who didn't get served last year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You still? Mr. Chairman, I'm asking the folks from the Youth Board program to come up. And again, this is a program this committee has been pretty familiar with over the years. There should be passed out to you two documents. One that's an analysis of the cost-benefit of the Youth Build, and that was done over the last, it's been done repeatedly in the last few years. It's basically to indicate to this committee and to Minnesota what happens when we invest in our youth in this program. The returns are pretty amazing in terms of crime prevention, a lot of other things. I think one of the aspects that this committee particularly appreciates is that these young people build houses, and they're targeted to homeless and very low-income people. And I believe, if they don't mention it, I'm going to mention how much that's worth. It's more than we put into most of our housing programs, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to let you hear what happened to the Youth Build program last year, the proposed cuts, the little bit of saving that happened in this committee that was very, very helpful to the program. Someone could check by. And we have a week to speak as well.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alan Slinsky. I'm with the Guadalupe Alternative Programs, and we have a youth build program that's been there for about 13 years, so we're very experienced at this. Over that time, we have worked with hundreds and hundreds of students, young people. We've graduated tons of young citizens into this community. We're very proud of what we do, and we're very happy to be able to testify today. As Karen was saying, over the last few years, our allocation has gone down dramatically. We were at about $900,000 just a couple years ago. Then we were reduced down to about $750,000 in 2003. And then we were out of the governor's budget last year. Fortunately, through the help of many members of this committee and several others in the department, we found some funding through the governor's Workforce Development Council, which helped us dramatically. All the programs would have had to quit if we were not able to find that funding. So we're very excited about that. We really want this to continue. This budget is very, very important to us. Without this, we would not be able to function. Over the last few years, we've done a cost-benefit analysis with this program, and I'm not sure if we can just hand these up. Oh, that? Okay. Okay. So if you want to look, there's a little cheat sheet that I have
here.
A little shorter version. According to this, for every $1 spent invested in Youth Build, there is a $3 dividend to the state in tax revenue. Many of these students come out of juvenile corrections. They are, over 90% of them are dropouts from school. And research has shown again and again, if we have diversion programs for them, if we have opportunities for them outside of incarceration, they will do much better in the long term. With this program, it's a pre-apprenticeship, so we teach them building trades. We teach them a lot of the skills, work ethic, and the skills they need for their future jobs. We are serving about 260 young people per year. But we have at least 400 to 500 on the waiting list at any given time. We are also looking at expanding. We would love to expand into other fields in medicine and technology because those are the growing fields of the future. However, it requires funding for that, especially continued funding. It's very difficult to exist when you don't know where your next dollar is coming from or if you will have it. With that, I would like to turn it over to some others that are going to be testifying a little bit about this program.
I think we're going to hear from one of our youth. Do you want
to? Hello, my name is Sherry Crable. I'm the youth field coordinator at the City Academy. The City Academy, like Alan's group, we've been around for about 13 years, and over that time we've built over 40 houses in St. Paul on the east side, and we're now currently doing remodeling and really doing a real push on getting students. Like Alan, we have a huge waiting list to get students into our program. It's imperative that the budget, you know, really stays, you know, at least where we're at. But one of the things that we have going for us is working with cities. The city of St. Paul has been wonderful to work with. Also, the city of Oakdale. We're currently building a remodel where we're taking a problem property and turning it into two townhouses. But I'd like to introduce one of my students, Dwayne Johnson, and he will talk a little bit about youth build.
Welcome to our committee. Give you a name for the record, Dwayne.
Hi, my name is Dwayne Johnson. I've been at City Academy for 4 years. This is my final year in high school. And the youth build program has taught me so much about construction, and is considering I'm going into that work after I'm done because of the youth build program. And it did a lot for me, or else I would have never came to school. I hated school. I never wanted to come. And when I got the youth build program, it made me want to do something and get out there, because school was just boring to me.
Mm-hmm. And that's all I have to say.
Let's see your thumbs.
All 10 fingers, he has more.
You want to step forward? Mr. Chairman, I want to have one more person testify, and then we'll be done with this part.
You will. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joyce Eisinger. I'm from the Carver Scott Educational Cooperative. We are located in Chaska, Minnesota, and we work with all schools in Carver and Scott County. We also have never lost any fingers. I wouldn't be proud of that. The cooperative has been around for almost 30 years, and I'm in my 23rd year there, so I've seen a lot of students come and go over the years. We touch about 10,000 students a year in about 60 programs in Carver and Scott counties. And still to this day, hands down, youth build is one of the best things we do. Because of what you've just heard, youth build teaches kids skills. It helps them earn credit toward high school graduation. And it gives them real work. School can be boring for some students, and not all students learn the same. And that's the message that I hope that you hear from me today, is that education is becoming more and more standards-based and more test-oriented. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I think we all need to be accountable. But all students learn in different ways. And for students we work with, it's easier for them to learn things like math skills when they're putting rafters on a building rather than sitting in a desk with a piece of paper. So please hear that today. That's what makes youth build work. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to remind you the gravity of the situation, if we do not fund, if we do not fill in this gap, this time this program will decease all over the state. And it's not just, we've got people here today from the Twin Cities and the metro, a suburban area. We also have rural youth programs that couldn't come on short notice. And I do want to just brag about one thing for this committee, which is something that you and I have talked about, Mr. Chairman, is that if we put a dollar figure beyond the cost estimate, cost effectiveness, cost-benefit analysis that you have before you, you'll notice on the last page it says it doesn't account for the housing that's built. $15 million in 2003, I think it was. 150 units. You take about $100,000, you know, give or take a few, some more, some less. We don't even appropriate that for our, you know, hundreds of dollars to appropriate. So that's beyond the cost-benefit analysis that you have before you. We are building housing with this group that benefits the state, and it's targeted to low-income people. Just want one final group. They have some kids with them who have to go back to school, too.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I
have some questions here?
Can you understand where that housing then goes to? Is it sold, or is it donated? Because that's wonderful that they're contributing. I want to make sure I understand where it's going.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that housing goal is low-income housing, so it is sold to low-income individuals and families.
And the proceeds go where?
Depending the, oftentimes they are appropriated. The development agency, which is a nonprofit in our case, uses that money to reinvest it in the community to purchase another house that we rehab, and then it's cyclical. Yes.
City Academy.
Good question.
We've got a partnership with Twin Rivers Community Land Trust. So Twin Rivers basically sells houses to low-income people and still maintain the ownership of the land, so it lets people get into a house that's affordable and keeps the cost down.
Mm, that's a good idea.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that just one thing. No youth build program operates in isolation. Everybody has partners. Everybody's in a different community. So our big partners are the Scott County Housing and Redevelopment Authority and the Carver County HRA. Everybody operates a little differently. So the houses that we have built, the HRA has owned, and then they pass those on to their clients and get their clients into their first housing, typically. Sometimes we build commercial housing. Right now we're putting an addition on one of our schools. We built the Juvenile Alternative Facility, which is located in Jordan, which is a residential corrections placement for 16 kids who kind of come and go based on circumstances. So we're all doing a variety of things, but we all have partners.
Thank you. Representative Horry. Do you know where those houses are on the east side?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't, and that's actually a question that I had. And I'd actually ask someone with Youth Build, could you tell us where you're building these houses? I mean, I see you've got 10 agencies listed here. I just want you to understand that on the east side, there's somewhere approximately 30 to 40% of Ramsey County's low-income housing. And you're just adding more concentration to the place. I mean, I'm just wondering, do you ever build low-income housing in, like, North Oaks or Shoreview or Minnetonka or maybe Afton? Those places that could probably use it because they have so many service jobs going out there, but they don't have any housing for the people that take up those jobs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll answer that question. I would love to see a branch of Youth Build in North Oaks if we got additional funding. Right now, we're trying to rehab the houses in our community where our school was located, and that is we're rehabbing a house now that was going to be condemned unless we had worked on it, and we're going to be building new houses. So primarily, what we tend to do is work on the housing that's within our own community. But we're certainly interested in expanding. There are houses in Chaska, different places in the suburbs. So we really do try to spread it throughout the Minnesota, throughout all of Minnesota.
Mr. Kim, is there money?
I would actually really appreciate some indication of how many housing units you're rehabbing or building in areas that are not already facing challenges. It's getting to be very frustrating when an area feels like it becomes just a dumping ground. I've already had the Minnesota Housing Finance coming into my office talking about where they're putting housing, and I've flat out told them I'm not supporting the $25 million in low-income housing because it always ends up going in the same place. And our areas are getting tired of it.
Mr. Chairman, for our City Academy Youth Build, we've just started a new program. Basically, we've done a remodel in Cottage Grove. We're working on our second house in Oakdale. So we're looking at areas that are traditionally not the low-income areas. The one that we're working on right now is right across the street from Tartan High School. And it's a really nice neighborhood. And it's so we're not in that typical low-income area that you're describing. And the real purpose is the city actually came to us saying we need to work with somebody to get affordable housing in their communities. So we've actually done the first two houses in Oakdale that really have come from, grassroots of let's fix problem houses that are not traditionally in that low-income area.
Mr. Chair. Oakdale has done their particular share, and I have always appreciated that particular part, but I don't want to prolong this particular hearing. I just wanted to actually make my point that you need to look at other places to start partnering with people to put in low-income housing.
Joyce is going to bust if I don't recognize her. Carver County is not the cheapest place to go either.
I was just going to add that. Thank you for recognizing that. One of the issues, like I said, every youth build program is different. Every youth build program works within their own community needs. And in Carver County and Scott County also, one of the issues is not so much low-income housing as so much housing that is not affordable to most of the population. The cost of rent, the cost of housing has just escalated, and the thought of a first-time homeowner is becoming, you know, less likely. We've got three houses that have gone to Powell Lake. One's gone to Jordan, two in Shaska. We're currently working on a house that will go to New Prague. One of the issues, as I said, is land. And so the Scott County HRA has purchased three lots in New Prague, and we will be building three houses for those three lots. But as the cost of land increases, those locations are getting harder to come by.
Mm-hmm. Representative Slawick, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, Oakdale is my district, so I just want to say keep up the good work, and I find those Tartan, so I know right where that is.
Any other questions from members? Okay, you have one more.
One more program, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And that's the Minnesota Youth Program.
Thank you very much, by the way.
There's two kids who are going to be going back to school from there. I want to thank the youth, particularly this morning, who have come in to talk with us all. Can you take that away? Again, Mr. Chairman, as we're getting ready here, all of these programs are programs that have been, you know, in our budget in the past. They all got cut last time, one eliminated, and now we're going to hear from the Minnesota Youth Program.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ann Olson, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association, which is a consortium of the 16 workforce service areas in Minnesota who provide the Minnesota Youth Programs. Last year, Minnesota's youth program, as the others, was set to be eliminated in the governor's budget. We appreciate the money that was found. Unfortunately, it's a one-time allocation from the Workforce Development Fund that did restore about 75% of our funding, but still leaves a rather large gap. In Minnesota, within the past 4 years, in the chart that is being handed around, you'll see that we continue to lose funding. Each year, there's an unmet need of countless youth. Based on poverty statistics in the state of Minnesota, there are about 70,000 youth this year that would qualify for this program. You can see the number that we're actually able to serve. Speaking with some of the providers, they say that if funding wasn't a limitation, they'd have the capacity to serve about a quarter of the youth that are eligible for the program. And just two other brief points I'd like to make before I turn it over to the real experts here. But as our workforce investment boards interact with employers, there's obviously a need for skilled workers, but they say a lot of times the challenge is more so finding employees who are able to show up to work on time, who understand basic expectations of being an employee. And the Minnesota Youth Program instills those values in the youth who participate. And in November, three of the four awards given in the 10-state area by the Department of Labor for Youth Programs did come to Minnesota, which I think just shows that we're doing a good job here with the programs that we are able to provide with the funding that we do have. And we just hope that we'd be able to provide those services to even more youth.
Welcome to our committee.
Hi. My name is Fu Zhang. First, I just started off introducing myself. I'm 17 years old, and I go to South High School my senior this year. I got involved with the Minneapolis Employment Training Program through my workforce center, which was a summer job, which I first had for the first time. I was really excited for having the first job, and after that first job, I was really determined to, like, continue working and just going through school and all this stuff. My older siblings, they also got involved with it too, and they're about 34. They're married, they're off doing very well, and it's all because of these programs that was allowed back then and not so today. And if the budget was cut, I don't know like where I would be at either. Right now I'm just going to school, like, no, I'm working part time. Just really determined to go to school. They've definitely helped me learn a lot, like job working skills, meeting new people, and just working with people overall in general. I've got like I don't know, I've received so much opportunities from these programs. I'm also the youth representative from the Workforce Investment Act, and I don't know, I don't think I would ever be there if it wasn't for these programs, because these programs have provided so much for me. So that's about it.
Hi, my name is Andre Walker. I started by introducing myself. 20 years old. I go to the Minneapolis Community Technical College. I first started off with the Summer Youth Program in 98. Stayed involved with the program for 5 years. And part of me being involved with that program, I gained a lot of leadership skills. You know, I come from a low income and community, so you know, it was very easy for me to, you know, get in trouble, you know, or be like another statistic, you know, that's really not trying to stay focused, you know, and put more effort in, you know, and make myself a better person. Part of me getting involved with college is because of the organization Youth Care I'm involved with. You know, I got a chance and opportunity to meet people from different ethnic backgrounds, you know, and learn about diversity and learn job skills, you know, that are actually doing some good, you know, later on in the future. And that's why right now I'm still employed. I just think that the youth program serves youth for a very good purpose, and if we don't have this in the future, you know, I think that things will go bad for some of the youth in the metro area and the suburban area, because it not only gives them job skills, but it shows them, you know, how there's a possibility to do whatever you want in life, you know, and you got to start off from somewhere. And being involved with some youth program, that is a start, and you know, it actually gives you ideas of how to go about doing things in your life.
We just accepted it.
One side of the room. This is just for Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Norm Champ. I'm a program director for an organization called Tree Trust, which is a nonprofit, and we have been a contractor that works with the Minnesota Youth Program funding since I started in 1977. That's a long time ago. I thought I'd bring crutches today to go for a sympathy vote, and if that doesn't work, I have a whole pile of kittens out in the foyer I could bring in. I've worked with Tree Trust since 77 because of people just like these youth here. It's an amazing program to see the growth that kids can accomplish if we as adults give them an opportunity. The street recruits all the time. The street is recruiting every minute of every day. If we don't have a summer youth employment program for those kids, I just put to you, what are those children and young people going to be doing the rest of the time? They'll be out of school in the summer. They'll have June, July, and August with their time unoccupied. The youth that we work with want to work. They want to work. They want to do good things for the community. It's about $1,000 a youth to employ them in the Summer Youth Employment Program. And about half of that money goes right into the kids' pockets. Most of the time, it's the first money that they've earned for the summer or for their life. And it's money that they've earned. It's not a check that just comes in the mail. They don't come to work, they don't get paid. Simple concept. And that's, as Ann said, it's a lot of the things that we do every year. We're just trying to give these kids a place where they can come. They put forth good effort. They receive their paycheck. If they're not, they don't have maturity, they decide they don't know this is not for them. Well, we've got 10 people waiting for their job, and we find someone else for it. Last year, I know the idea was circulated that, well, the state gets federal funding, so we don't need the MYP funding. Unfortunately, that's not really the case. If the Minnesota Youth Program is not funded, there will virtually be no summer youth program in the state of Minnesota. I just implore upon you not to rely on the federal government to fund summer youth employment programming. The federal money has been going down every year. It's going to take another 10 to 15% hit this year. And it's not, just not going to replace the summer youth employment program money. I'd love to entertain any questions. I could go on for hours.
We don't have that much.
I know.
Any questions from the membership? Seeing none, we'll lay this House File 2068 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you for hearing this bill, and I want to thank the youth for coming. I know they have to go back to school now or to work, and I appreciate that. I hope they can.
We appreciate them coming, too.
Find the way. Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Hopper with a bonding bill. And I have removed House File 2989 for possible inclusion in the bonding priorities. Welcome to our committee.
Hello, Chairman Gunther and members of the committee. My name is Representative Jean Coffey from District 27B. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to explain House File 2989. I do have an oral amendment, Mr. Chair.
Very well. You want to give it?
That is on page 1, line 7, to delete grants and insert a grant. And to follow along that line, delete local units of government and insert the City of Austin.
Everybody understand that oral amendment? I remove that oral amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Pass.
Thank you.
So amended this the way you want it.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate the time to come before you today. The City of Austin has, over the decades, suffered devastating floods due in part to our topography and location, but none were as severe as the one we had in September 2004. During the last legislative session, we came forward with a bonding request because of the huge and immediate need. We very much appreciated the assistance that we received from the state to date. Last year, it was still too close to the event to have a really good handle on the impact and what it would take to address the situation. So that was a starting point. We hope to now turn into a multi-phase recovery and rebuilding project. This is not unlike what Roseau did when they were flooded. Our request today represents a plan of action and a request for funding based on more complete information. With me today from the City of Austin is Mayor Bonnie Reitz and City Engineer John Erickson. And so we have introductory comments from Mayor Reitz, and then we'll have Mr. Erickson explain more in detail what the project involves. Thank you.
Welcome to our committee. I went and toured the flood when it was happening. This committee has oversight for public infrastructure, and flood abatement will be in Chairman Osmond's committee. So welcome to our committee. I remember specifically the grocery store, because I'm a grocer.
Okay.
And the grocer put all his computers on top of his door freezers, thinking they're safe up there. He didn't know that they floated. So they popped up, and all those computers went underneath the door freezers. So it was really special, especially tragic for me. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Representative Gunther. Thank you very much, and members of the committee. We're pleased to be here today, and we thank you very much for listening to our program of flooding in Austin. We want to thank you. We have been working since actually 1980 on situations with flooding in our community, and the legislature has been very supportive of the different programs that we've had. We've actually removed over 250 homes from the floodplain with a lot of help from the state of Minnesota, so we thank you very much. We're coming today
today because, as Representative Poppy said, in September of 2004, the city of Austin flooded again. And if you would take a look at the packet that we gave you, we're going to go through that. And I'd like you to look at that first page. And what you're seeing there is Main Street, Austin. It's just amazing. If you take a look at the picture on your top right, and on the left part of the picture, you'll see the Spam Museum, which you haven't visited yet. If you haven't, you need to come to Austin and visit. It's a lot of fun. But the street that goes right in front of it, and on the right-hand side of the picture, the low-lying building, is Austin Packaging. That is our Main Street. So the Main Street of Austin just was flooded unbelievable in 2004. And then if you look at the other pictures on the first page, the bottom right, if you look at the top of it, you see that street? That's Main Street. And then the rest of it is flooded. So it was just devastating to our community. And I have to say that Representative Ruth was also in Austin, and we shared a piece of apple pie.
Yes.
And so when I looked at you, that first thought went through my mind. We sat at a home and we visited it, and it was when Representative Butnick came and visited, and you were with him. And Governor Plante, that's right. Excuse me, it was the governor, and we had a piece of apple pie at one of the homes that had flooded. So thank you also for coming. But on the second page, it just tells you a little bit about Austin. Our population is we're over 23,000. We're the county seat of Maurer County. And our economic basis is agricultural and food industry. And I just want you to take a look at the four major employers that we have. Three of them were directly impacted by the flooding. Three of them flooded. Hormel Foods, Austin Packaging, and Austin Medical Center. Weyerhaeuser did not flood, but as the city engineer pointed out to me, they're very much affected by it because Weyerhaeuser is the one that makes the boxes for Hormel Foods. So they also are affected by the flooding in our community. If you would then look at the next page, too, this is the main part of our city. Just look at what happens to the Cedar River. And this is when Blooming Prairie, a community about 17 miles to the north of us, receives 12 inches of rain. The chief of police called me early on the morning of the day of the flooding and said, it's coming. We are going to be having a major flood. It's very flat land coming down from Blooming Prairie, all of that water, and you can see how it impacts the city of Austin. I will never forget taking a ride in the governor's helicopter that first afternoon and watching the flood water rush into the north part of one of our restaurants and out the south door. Unbelievable. But our city engineer, John Erickson, now will take you through the rest of our program and the requests that we're making today. So thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. What I will try to do is provide a background of where all the water is coming from, some history of the flooding, the impacts on the community, and our proposed project. To understand the flooding in Austin, you just have to have a general background of the information. Austin is at the end of the funnel for three streams that are drained from Maurer County, Freeborn County, Dodge County, and Steele County, the Cedar River, Turtle Creek, and Dobbins Creek. I did attach a copy of the watershed to that, and it does show, and Austin is the end of the funnel, and all that water does end up in Austin. We've had a long history of flooding in Austin, but the flooding events have changed. The five highest floods in Austin have all occurred since 1978. The flood events now occur in the summer versus the spring runoff. We always used to associate flooding in Austin area with the March, April, with the spring runoff. Now the floods are occurring July, August, and September. Why is that? The land use has all changed. It's become more developed, greater flooding. With the increased flooding levels, the impact on our commercial and industrial properties have really changed. After the 1978 flood, our flood efforts, our flood mitigation efforts were really addressed towards the residential property. In the last two floods, in 2000 and 2004, we've experienced higher floods, and they've now started impacting our commercial and industrial areas. You can look at the 10 highest known floods of record in their order of magnitude. September 15th, 2004, the flood Mayor Reitz is talking about. was our flood of record, 25 feet on the gauge at the wastewater treatment plant. July 10th, 2000, 4 years prior to that, that was our flood of record. And you can just see the magnitude is continuing to increase, and the properties that are impacted are changing. Like we did mention that we have removed 250 residential homes. I think we've been very successful with that program. We thank everyone that has provided funding for that. But now we're at the point with the commercial and industrial property that we really need to do something. I've included a sheet here that shows the studies. We have studied this problem to death. I mean, we have had a number of studies, and a lot of the studies have been Corps of Engineers studies. Unfortunately, those studies, the cost-benefit, just we never meet the formula. Working with the Corps of Engineers, we just cannot seem to get the project done, and we're to the point now that we know we just need to do something locally, and it has to be done, and we just can't wait for other people to come and help us as far as the Corps of Engineers. After the 2004 flood, it took us approximately a year to recover from that and restore our infrastructure. And then we started looking at what we needed to do. And we broke our overall flood mitigation project into 9 phases, and we prioritized those. The project we're going to be talking to you today about is our North Main project. We actually undertook a study for this project. The study was funded with local dollars, approximately $90,000 across the city of Austin. The project scope was to evaluate the feasibility and determine the cost to structurally protect the property along and adjacent to North Main. Property in this area that is supposed to be protected and that are impacted by the floods, just going to touch on them a little bit. Hormel Foods, they have their flagship plant right there. Employs 1,550 people, processes 19,000 hogs a day. The plant had to be shut down in 2004. In talking to them, their economic impact right there, their business interruption is $630,000 per day for business interruption. With processing 19,000 hogs per day, another interesting fact is that those hogs are purchased from the agricultural community is a purchase value of about $3 million per day that they're buying hogs from the farmers surrounding Austin. They also discharge 2.1 million gallons of wastewater per day, and that was touch and go the entire event during 2004. Quality Pork Processors is connected right with Hormel. They employ 1,400 people. They were shut down also during the 2004 flood. Hormel Corporate Office South, they employ approximately 200 people. That is part of the SPAM Museum, and the Hormel Computer Center is located in that building also. APC Food, which was impacted, shut down for, I think, approximately 3 weeks. They have 275 people working for them. They have a $7 million annual payroll. In the last two floods, 2000 and 2004, they experienced $4.3 million of damages. Huge number. Mayo Medical Center. The infrastructure of the Mayo Medical Center was threatened. With that, there's actually a letter attached from Mayo Medical Center. They have 6,000 patient visits, 900 people. You can just see from these numbers that the employment base for Austin and Moore County is really concentrated in this area. And in addition to these, there were other numerous businesses that were impacted by that. The project benefits provide flood protection to the developed commercial and industrial property. Grow our industrial job base. Both Hormel and APC have indicated that if we could mitigate the flood damages, they would look at growing. And then just provide the stability to the existing businesses. The total project cost that we're looking at is $11.4 million. It's broken into 12 phases of work. It involves property acquisition and then structural walls and berms. The large board in front of us represents what the project is, and if there's any specific questions, we can try to answer those. And then the next sheet also shows what the proposed project is and the benefits to that. So with that,
carries.
Yes, and so the ultimate goal that we want to do now with this project is to remove or to protect all the structures along the river. And this time we're really looking at businesses and the economic impact to our community. In the other floods, we've been removing lots of homes, but in the flood of 2004, it really impacted our major businesses with where the water went. If you will look on the next page, you can see once again the building that you're looking at there is Austin Packaging, and the street that runs in front of it is our main street. The restaurant that I was telling you about, where the water was running in the north door and out the south door, is the building at the top of the picture. Terrible, terrible thing for our community, for individual businesses. So we thank you very much today for your interest and concern in our work with flooding in Austin, Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions from the members? Representative Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know which one of the testifiers might be willing to answer this particular question, but south of Austin, is there any other major or minor Minnesota city until you get to the Iowa border? Because if we're going to push all this water somewhere, I'd rather push it into Iowa. I mean,
we'll erase that from the tape.
Yeah, you know, it's, as politicians in Minnesota, we make comments about other states and have to
try to change those new license plates, you know what?
Actually, my question is, I'm looking at this, and there's, I think, four berms that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell the committee how high these dikes or berms have to be? And it appears that there are three places in here where there's a thinner wall or whatever you want to call it. Will this will keep any waters from spilling out into the residential and city area? Because if I look at it in the top on your map, on this map,
yes.
The west levee starts after what looks to be the bridge under I-90, but you've got several city blocks there that don't look protected. This is all going to, you're not going to be having spaces where that water can get through and into other parts of the city or onto a typical floodplain. The questions are, how high? And if we get this done, we're not going to have Austin coming back in 100 years, you know, to ask for more.
Sure, good question. Mr. Austin, would you like
to attempt to answer those questions? The berm height averages between 4 to 6 feet high, and that depends upon the elevation. We have surveyed everything. We actually modeled this entire area. The areas that you see gaps in, those are actually high points. So those berms will be brought into a high point. For instance, there's a library there that was built for a flood protection elevation that was not impacted. So the structural improvements would tie into those high points. So they look like gaps in there, but they're actually tying into existing high points already. So that would not happen. That would not make its way through. As far as you also asked a question about a regional impact, we are currently working with the entire region, all four counties, the existing Turtle Creek watershed, soil conservation services, trying to create some sort of management organization to manage the surface water prior to it arriving at Austin. And that's an ongoing effort. In the past, we found that the people on the top of the hill aren't real concerned about the people at the bottom of the hill. But in this case, we're really finding that I think because of how frequent and the severity of the floods, people on top of the hill are really willing to partner with us in this case now.
Thank you, Mayor.
Oh, and the limiting factor at the very north end of that is that's I-90. And I-90 is the bridge opening that comes underneath I-90 that really limits the amount of water coming into that area. Through this project and through the modeling that we've done, under a 500-year event, it'll increase the water elevation on the north side of I-90 by 1/16 of a foot, or approximately 2.5 inches. North side of I-90, there is a residential neighborhood there. There are 17 homes that are impacted by surface water there. Currently, the City of Austin has a FEMA grant for the acquisition of those 17 homes, so that will, this project will not impact those homes, or if it did, it'd be 1,600, but those homes will be removed. And it's a voluntary acquisition, and they've all signed up for the project.
Representative Ruth.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to thank you for coming and really encourage our committee to support this because, yes, I was there, as Mary said, and it was devastating to the community. And to walk through just into the houses and the businesses, it's crippling for communities. And it did affect other areas of Steele County as well, but I think most of that has been taken care of. But we need to have the preventive measures now in place. So thanks again for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the committee taking a look at House File 3053.
Representative Clark moves House File 3053 for possible inclusion in our omnibus or in our bonding priorities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3053 is a bonding request for $2 million to support lighting improvements on one of the most popular, perhaps the most popular outdoor recreation area in the state of Minnesota, the Grand Round Scenic Bikeway, or Byway. There are bikeways and all kinds of walkways and other things. This scenic byway starts at Minnehaha Falls in Minneapolis. It goes through the southern and southwest parts of the city around Lake Harriet, Lake Calhoun in my district, and up to the north side of Minneapolis, and then east and ending in northeast Minneapolis. As I mentioned, Mr. Chairman and members, this area is the first scenic byway in the country and one of only a few in the nation, and as such attracts a lot of visitors. In just the chain of lakes alone, there are 5 million annual visits, and again, making this the most popular outdoor recreation area in the state. And as such, this has been a very, very important regional asset. Our visitors here are not just from the city of Minneapolis. We have a lot of suburban visitors, as can be attested in the parking lots around the lakes, which are often full on nice spring, summer, and fall days. And I think we have also a lot of visitors from out of town, rural Minnesota, and around the country that make this an important stop in their visit to the Twin Cities. It's been a fixture in terms of different national images of our region, from the Mary Tyler Moore Show to any sporting event in the Twin Cities. They cut away for scenes from the parks. Recently there was, I believe, a Monday night football game. They showed the Lake of the Isles park area as well. And Paul McCartney, in his recent visit, decided to take a spin on a bike on the scenic byway. So this is truly a jewel in our recreational crown, as it were, and a very unique area. We have, unfortunately, a crumbling infrastructure as part of this. There's some images of some of the lighting fixtures and poles. We believe that it's very important now to not only upgrade this for aesthetic purposes, but in the long run we'll save money with more energy-efficient lighting. And obviously, when we have these poles that look a little like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, there are certainly safety issues as well. I have one witness here who can answer again and outline some of the more technical issues related to this project. John Wirtjes, who's the Director of Traffic and Parking Services for the City of Minneapolis, is here. Mr. Chair, unless you have any questions of me and at this point, I would just defer to him.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. John Wirtjes, Director of Parking Services with City of Minneapolis Public Works. Thanks for listening with regards to the parkway lighting request that we're bringing forward. A couple of just basic facts I'll share with the system. Most of the system was installed in the 1970s. As Representative Hornstein had alluded to in the handouts, there is some interesting photos there of the cube and the globe, which is pretty much the standard that's out there today. What we are planning to move forward with is a new fixture that the Park Board and the Public Works staff work diligently through a planning process to come to a better selection in a light that really addresses the appearance, the safety, and the environment and energy issues that go along with lighting systems these days. The work will be basically a construction program encompassing the conduit and underground cabling, which is completely worn out, and right now we do kind of a string, you might say Christmas tree lighting effect through the parkway to try to keep it going on some of the underground lighting. Likewise, we do the footings and foundations and then the poles and the fixtures. And with that, I'll be available for any questions.
Any questions for the testifier or for Representative Hornstein? Representative Nelson?
So we're talking, this is the whole parkway system from Victor Drive all the way down to Kenwood, and the whole system we're talking about replacing the light.
Yeah, correct. It it extends north through Worth Parkway, then up through the Victory Memorial Parkway, you know, on the north side, then crosses the river, and then heads back into northeast Minneapolis.
Thank you. Any further questions for Representative Hornstein and the testifier? Seeing none, Representative Clark renews her motion to have House File 3053 laid over for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members, for your consideration.
Okay. Does he got someone to move it?
Yeah.
Representative Ellison, welcome to our committee. Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to move House File 3052 on behalf of Representative Ellison.
To pass and go to the General Register.
There you go.
Welcome, Representative Ellison.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing this bill. This bill I would describe it as essentially a technical change. As you know, in 2003, legislature enacted legislation around background checks for people who would provide legal non-licensed family child care. And we did that to make sure that anybody who would provide legal non-licensed family child care would be a person who is safe, who could provide safe, good care. And so there were limitations on people who could provide that care in terms of people's criminal records, how long they would take before they could provide that care, and a number of things were done. But one of the provisions that was done is and you'll notice in this whole bill there's like only a small change, is on page 4 of the bill, line 414. And this particular paragraph doesn't have to do with restricting people with criminal records. What it says is this, is that a person who's been identified by a child protection agency in a county where the provider resides or a county where the provider has resided or the statewide child protection database as the person allegedly responsible for physical or sexual abuse of a child within the last 7 years. Now, I have a constituent who brought this term allegedly to my attention because they got caught up on it. As you all know, allegedly means that somebody accused you. It doesn't mean it was true. It doesn't mean it's been proven by any level of any quantum of evidence. And so what we did is just what we believe is a technical change to raise the level to preponderance of the evidence, which provides a more objective standard, a standard which an objective neutral can look at and evaluate the level of evidence and provide some kind of
of due process for a non-licensed child care provider who has in the past maybe had an accusation. This change is about past events. It's not something that would crop up in the course of, so for example, somebody were licensed and it happened after that period, this wouldn't apply to that. This would apply to somebody who was having a background check and would give folks more than just more protection than just being accused. So with that, I would like to share with you, Mr. Chair, that Mr. Jerry Kubley, Kerber, sorry, Mr. Kerber, of the Department of Human Services is here, not to oppose or support the bill, but simply to provide some information for the committee as to what this change would do. So,
Representative Ellison, before we go to the testifier, is it okay if I take questions from...
Absolutely, let's do it.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ellison. I don't know if there may or may not be an attorney on this particular committee, but I'm not one. And I know there's... I know there's three or four levels of evidence, and clear convincing is one, but where does preponderance of evidence come into that particular level? Is it the highest, is it the lowest, or is it somewhere in between?
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, you're right. There are different standards of proof. And this standard is the normal civil standard of proof. It is the kind of proof that is required that any time that you have a civil matter. So, for example, any time you're not taking away somebody's liberty, but you're dealing with perhaps a right or perhaps money damages in some situations, that's the standard of proof we're talking about. So, the highest standard of proof is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's when you're going to take somebody's liberty away. That's the standard of proof that must be met. The next standard of proof is clear and convincing. That's when you're going to that involves a liberty interest too. If you're going to take somebody's probation away and put them in jail, if you're going to commit somebody or do something like that, the next standard is proof beyond a preponderance of the evidence, and that just means more likely than not. It just means more likely than not. You know, there's a better chance, 51% chance, as opposed to, you know, like that. So that's what that is.
Thank you.
That's for Representative Nelson.
So this means that, Mr. Chairman, this means that somebody that's not convicted could still get restricted from being able to do child care.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, yes, it does. If you're providing providing child care, and you are accused of physical or sexual abuse of a child, but you never get charged or convicted or brought through the normal criminal justice system, you can still be restricted under this bill if there's proof, if you adopt this bill, if it's more likely than not that the abuse, sexual abuse occurred, then they couldn't be licensed. What we're saying is that at this point, the current state of the law is that if somebody accuses, and probably everybody in this room has been accused of something they didn't do, you know, right. And then there's all kind of reasons that people in these child care situations might make a false allegation. The provider gets into an argument with a parent over anything. Oh, well, I'll fix you. And then the reviewing agency will find, well, there's nothing to this. But when the person goes to be licensed, I mean, what is the agency employee supposed to do? Well, the bill says alleged. And even though there's nothing to this allegation, you were accused. So maybe you can't be licensed now. I don't think that fits with any of our sense of fairness.
All right. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm from the Department of Human Services, where I'm the Director of the Licensing Division.
And we at the licensing division do licensing a variety of programs, including child care, and we also do about 200,000 background studies a year. I want to be clear that, as Representative Ellison has said, this pertains to legally non-licensed child care, and these are a little different background study and a little different process, but it's very parallel to the licensing process. And so he asked me to just talk about it just a little bit and make sure that everybody's clear on what the changes actually do. A couple of points. I think the first is that it does change, as Representative Ellison said, the standard from there being a mere allegation about somebody to there actually having been a finding of substantiated maltreatment by a county. Anybody can make an allegation about anybody to a county child protection system. All you need to do is pick up the phone and make a call. Somebody can allege that I may have neglected my children or something far worse. And then there is an allegation on the record. The county in that case is required to do an investigation, an objective, independent investigation, and come to a determination about whether under that statute the definitions of maltreatment have been met. And there are standards in place for how those investigations must be completed. This would make sure that only those cases that have gone through an investigation and the county has made that important determination that child abuse or neglect is substantiated would come into the mix here for these purposes. The second important part here is that it does repeat that evidentiary standard, as you've been talking about, of preponderance of evidence. And that is the same standard that's also already in the child protection statute. So this is just making it very clear that that is the standard in place. That's also the standard that's in place in addition to the civil processes, all the administrative processes that apply throughout state government and county agencies. And so with our licensing world, it's preponderance of evidence is the standard that we use in all cases. The third part here that's important is that I think it makes it consistent with the next provision of this bill. If you look at paragraph G, is where it talks about there being a review of whether or not somebody was ever substantiated to be responsible for maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. It makes it clear in that provision that it has to have been substantiated. They have been determined to be responsible for it. It's not a mere allegation. This actually has gone through that investigation. And then the fourth thing I would mention is that what comes along with this, making sure that it's a finding of maltreatment that's been determined by the county, is that the individual who is alleged to have committed some maltreatment has some appeal rights. There's a world of due process that exists out there for good reason, and when we make a determination that somebody has committed maltreatment of a child, we must offer those appeal rights. The first thing that people get is an administrative reconsideration with the county. They get to say, you know, that your finding of maltreatment is not actually correct for these reasons. After that, if they don't get relief, then they actually have a hearing right before a referee at the Department of Human Services. So there's a good system and a strong system of due process available to these people. And what this bill does is it merely recognizes that existing process so that people are not denied an opportunity to participate in the child care assistance program merely because somebody made an allegation about them that the county determined to be without merit.
Any questions for Representative Ellison or the testifier? Seeing none, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 3052 pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you. Then? Thank you, members.
We already passed. We didn't, then, sorry.
Mr. Chair, I've got, there's one actual correction in one of the minutes.
Go ahead, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I ask that we reconsider the minutes from February 23rd.
Representative Mahoney moves we reconsider the minutes from the February 23rd meeting without objection. We'll order that. Go ahead.
On page 114, it had Senator Moore presenting the St. Paul Asian Community Center, and that was Senator Moore and myself.
Sure. Okay.
That correction could be made.
So we'll make that correction in the minutes on page 114. On the February 23rd?
Third
minutes. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the approval of the February 23rd minutes as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes. And the committee will be in adjournment.